I'm Kathleen Woodward. I'm director of the Simpson Center for the Humanities, and I'm very, very excited to be able to welcome you to this evening with Linda Beards, who is our COTS Distinguished Lecturer for this year. As you know, because you're here, we've been extremely fortunate to be able to count Linda Beards as a treasured faculty member for many years at the University of Washington. She has been an aesthetic, an intellectual gift to us, and an inspiration to so many of you, I know. The COTS lectures are in honor of Solomon COTS, who here was a beloved, I've been told, scholar of Byzantine history and also a leader at many, many different levels of the university. He was a faculty member in the history department, and he was also dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, and he served many, many other roles as well. The purpose of the lectures is to honor his memory and what he had given to the University of Washington, and it's also to honor these wonderful, wonderful people who have graced us with their intellect and their love of language, and of course, Linda Beards is one of those people. I want to thank Chelsea Schlievert, who I think has vanished into the hall for a moment. She's the woman in the red dress with the black belt, and she's responsible for, among other things, there she is, you see, for astute planning of this evening, and also for having this wonderful broadside for us in honor of the evening. It's something I think to treasure, a copy of Linda Beards' poem, 1934. So if you didn't pick one up, please do on your way outside of this evening's talk. I want also to say, and this is another first, on a more pragmatic and less aesthetic plane, you will find inside your program a survey. And if you didn't pick up a little pencil or don't have something with you, please pick one of those up on your way out and fill out the survey and return it to us. That will be very helpful to us in the future. I also want to announce, if you open your program, you're going to see that on January 17th, Doris Summer will be here. You have just got to meet her. She is an absolutely exuberant advocate for the arts and the humanities. She believes firmly that, in fact, the arts and humanities can help us shape and underpin more democratic communities, and she is a dynamo, I promise you. So please come. I know you will absolutely love her. And finally, I want to thank Rick Kenny, who is also one of my beloved colleagues, who is a poet as well, gifted like Linda Beards, and who is going to come and introduce Linda Beards to you. So thanks very much to Rick.
I wonder, can you hear me? I guess you can hear me okay. As I told Kathy when she first offered me this plum piece of reflected glory, this evening joins my favorite person with my favorite subject. As to my favorite person, here's what the world knows. Linda is one of the distinguished poets of her generation. She has published in the most prestigious places. Her 8 books have earned recognitions, prizes, and fellowships from the Seattle Arts Commission, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Ingram Merrill Foundation, the Guggenheim Foundation, the Poetry Society of America, and the MacArthur Foundation. She's one of the most decorated professors at the University of Washington. Here's what I know. Linda's poem, The Clips and Stallions, which I must have seen in the New Yorker a quarter century ago, was the occasion of what I think was the only altogether unprovoked anonymous fan letter I've ever written. Eventually we met and became colleagues. Over the years, her life work has fulfilled every promise I might have hoped or suspected for it. Her new and selected titled Flight is proof. It's a record of a perfectly brilliant artistic career. I want to say a few things about the subject, which, as I mentioned, belongs to my favorite mysteries. Over the door to the great reading room in Suzulo Library, arguably the most dignified and beautiful interior space on campus, in somewhat ornate calligraphic letters carved into the masonry side by side, are two words, poetry and science. Since I first noticed that, I've taken to standing my students there with a question in mind as their first item of homework. My question is this some kind of joke? Is this a mistake? Maybe maintenance operations should send a man over there with an air hammer and delete poetry and replace it with technology, I don't know, spirituality, not football. In a world where Stephen Hawking seems to have assumed the post of the Pythian oracle, where verse is regarded, if regarded at all, by more than one apostle of darkness in my acquaintance as a sort of quaintly defunct, not to say punishingly ineffective method of entertainment, in such a world, by what currently imaginable arguments could poetry and science be reckoned commensurate? On the other hand, in the Solomon Katz lecture of 1992, another colleague of ours, Hazard Adams, made a thrilling countervailing suggestion that there's just a single spectrum of symbolic representation, or fiction, as he called it, with myth and Mother Goose at one end, and science and mathematics at the other end. And he said that science, speaking mathematics, had turned its story inside out. Had turned the vocabulary of its interior into the fiction of an exterior, the imagined lineaments of the physical reality, toward which, outwardly, with a straight face, it purports to point. If that notion has had my head spinning for 20 years, I relate it simply to underscore the case that these relations between science and poetry are not settled matters. In his preface to the Lyrical Ballads, William Wordsworth takes the side of the Suzulo door. He imagines a time when the poet will follow the steps of the scientist, carrying sensation, he says, into the midst of the objects of science itself. The remotest discoveries of the chemist, the botanist, or mineralogist will be as proper objects of the poet's art as any upon which it can be employed. When Emerson called for an American poet, Whitman stepped right up with promptitude, but those poems of science have proven somewhat slower to materialize. And why is that? James Merrill in Mirabelle Books of Number, more or less commanded by enunciating spirits to write these poems of science himself, summarizes the collective wince. Poems of science? UGH. Ooh, is that how you pronounce that? The very thought. To squint through those steel-rimmed glasses of the congenitally slug-pale boy at school with his precipitates, his fruit flies, and slide rule. Science meant obfuscation and boredom. And that's the problem, isn't it? Though occasionally the Tuesday Science Times, gives us a good story. In a Princeton laboratory, we learn light has been slowed to the speed of a bicycle. Or 96% of the mass of the universe is missing and worse, undetectable. Or from certain genetic perspectives, we are 97% identical to orangutans and 35% indistinguishable from chrysanthemums, and so forth. And I put the flower homology closer to 70% in Linda's case. These are good stories, but most of the stories aren't so good. The classical poets gave us a heaven populous with gods, popping with their power, thrilling with their pheromones. The Renaissance posited a universe composed of tiny, indivisible particles called monads, and these were imagined to be alive. In those days, the brute creation spoke. Science silenced it, killed the monads into atoms, wholly depopulated heaven, replacing it with a sort of insensate mathematical smog. Such is the cosmogony our priesthood offers, and we're encouraged to believe in it as we believe in gravity, as fundamentalists. Well, if that's our story, if the gods and their companionable ilk have really closed up shop, then what's a poet to do? Linda Beard's solution has been to repopulate it. She uses real humans, like Charles Darwin, Gregor Mendel, Thomas Edison, Marie Curie, Dorothy Wordsworth, Matthew Brady, many others. The beautiful but abstract curvatures of a world defined by science are brought to humanism in her poetry. Finally, here's Wordsworth again on the unified field. If the time should ever come when what is now called science, thus familiarized to men, shall be ready to put on, as it were, a form of flesh and blood, the poet will lend her divine spirit to aid the transfiguration. This evening we have a chance to hear how such transfigurations may be managed. By Linda's invitation, we'll step behind the veil of the poem, so to speak, and learn about the process of their making. It's a privilege and a joy in prospect. Please welcome your distinguished Cotts professor and my dear friend, Linda Beards.
Now, technology is not my friend, so you have to bear with me. I'm going to use PowerPoint, and it's like the second time in my whole life I've ever done it. And so who knows what can happen, but we'll hope for the best. Thank you, Rick, for that beautiful, where are you, for that beautiful introduction. And it's very unusual for me, I think for poets in general, to be able to talk about their process with a diverse audience. And I'm so grateful to the Simpson Center and to the Cotts Committee for selecting me to do this. I also want to take just a moment and thank the Byron W. and Alice L. Lockwood Foundation. They have been supportive of me, of my research, my travel, my writing time, my classroom teaching for many years. And I really feel if it were not for their support, the poems that you'll hear tonight would not have been written. So, okay, I'm going to begin with a quote. It's from Nobel Prize-winning chemist Roald Hoffman. He's also a poet. We, scientist and poet, both want to understand the beautiful and terrible universe within and around us. For me, science influences poetry through suggesting metaphor. And I think that the conciseness of poetry has crept into some of my very best science. Unlike Roald Hoffman, I don't live my life as a poet and a scientist. My background in science is limited to a few lower division undergraduate classes, and I didn't excel in them. Why then has it become such a source of inspiration for me? And how did we become so entwined? And of greater interest, I think, how does that intertwining result in poetry? This talk will look at those questions in a very personal way. In it, I'll try to share my process with you as a poet as clearly as I can, using my poems as examples, plus slides, and even a snippet of YouTube video, if I can get it to work on this machine. With that in mind, I want to thank Rob Weller and Roger Chow, who are our department's technology wizards, for helping me get this together. I'm not an autobiographical poet. I just don't have the impulse for autobiography. For reasons unknown to me, but perhaps having to do with my early childhood years in Alaska, where I was trying through language to define a world that snow overnight would undefine, I initially was drawn in my poetry to explorers and their journeys. Franklin on the Erebus, Matthew Baird navigating the Horse Latitudes,
Scott at the South Pole with his white ponies, the upward reaches of Amelia Earhart's airplane or Neil Armstrong's spacecraft. Over the years, my focus shifted, tracking in a small way, perhaps, what could be seen as a shifting focus in exploration. Where the seekers who inspired earlier poems had turned outward to the mysteries of the visible world and outer space, they seem now to turn inward, downward, the unknown globe floating in its blue atmosphere, replaced by the globes of the cell, the atom, the electron, their vast frontiers made accessible through technology's increasingly accurate lens. So the why of it seems simply to be a poet inspired by the lives of others, drawn instinctively toward the unknowns of the earth and exploration of those unknowns, whether outward or inward. But the how of it, think of two strands intertwined. Okay. So our very first moment, Chelsea, it's there, but it's not there. Laptop. Once we get this, smooth, yay. Okay. I think it's okay. Yeah, we can change it. Okay, think of two strands intertwined. One, the red one, and it's a little hard. I think you can distinguish more easily the blue one. One, the red one, I'll call wonder. The other, the blue, I'll call looking away. I am in part a wonder-driven poet, as scientists in part are wonder-driven. Each of us fueled by the wonder that is awe and the wonder that is inquiry. Oh, we've gone forward a little bit here. I can't tell you how beautifully this worked. There we go. Okay. Here is a slide of Vermeer's The Geographer. I wonder what he's looking at, I remember thinking when I first saw this painting. Why did Vermeer direct his gaze out the window? Is the geographer trying to solve a problem by looking away? As Archimedes is said to have solved the problem of buoyancy by looking away from it, by taking a break and hopping into the bathtub and realizing that the water his body displaced gave him a theory? At the time I looked at this painting, I had just returned from a trip to Amsterdam, where I learned that flooded fields were dried out by planting cane, which drew the water up from the soil, then burning the cane. Sometime before, I had written in my notebook a brief entry about William Harvey, his discoveries about the circulation of the blood. I felt instinctively that these two facts about the use of cane and the circulation of the blood were the heart of a poem. How to unite them. Alone or together, each was incomplete for me. I had the wonder, now I needed to look away. I turned to art, found the geographer, and looked through him out the window at the imaginary cane stalks. I also wondered if he might be in a little pain, perhaps from his heart. And this is the poem that came from that. There, out the window, they are burning the flood fields, and the light that touches his forehead is softened by smoke. He is stopped in a long robe, blue with a facing of pumpkin. In his hand, the splayed legs of a compass taper to pin tips. It is noon. Just after dawn, he took for his errant heart a paper of powdered rhubarb and stoops to the window now, half in pain, half in love with the hissing fields. mile after mile of cane stalks fattened by drawn water. Such a deft pirouette, he thinks. Flood pulled up through the bodies of cane, then water cane burned into steam, and steam like mist on the fresh fields sucked dry for the spring planting. Powdered rhubarb, like talc on the tongue, and what of this heart, this blood? Harvey writes that the washes of pulse do not ebb, do not flow like the sea, but circle, draw up to the plump heart. And is that the centering spirit then? Red plum, red shuffling mole? When the floodwaters crested, the dark coffins bobbed down through the cane stalks like blunt pirogues, and then in the drift one slipper and the ferreting snouts of radishes. He touches his sleeve, looks down to his small desk, pale in its blanket of map, all the hillsides and carriageways, all the sunken stone walls reduced to the sweep of a pin tip. They are burning the flood fields, such a hissing, hissing, like a landscape of toads. And is that how blood circles back in its journey, like water through the body of the world? And the great flapping fire then, opening, withering, in its single posture, both swelling and fading. Is that the human heart? When my inspiration comes from science, the responses of wonder and looking away are at the center of my writing process. The wonder that is inquiry is asking, of course, what are the metaphoric implications of these disparate images or facts? The looking away is an act used to enrich those implications. The presence of science in the geographer occupies barely more than a few lines, yet the entire poem is based upon Harvey's discovery and its metaphoric implications for me. In the years that followed the geographer, I found myself drawn more and more frequently to scientific facts and images, all obtained through unbidden sources. That is, not by turning to existing scientific texts for possible poems, but by stumbling across the evocative fact, the luminous image, the red strand, then experimenting to see what might flare up, much the way the very young scientist on a sunny day, magnifying glass in hand, stumbles across the dried leaf. And I'm going to return to that idea of chance and stumbling in a moment. Perhaps receptivity to wonder is a condition experienced most easily by children. But for some poets and scientists, and I'm thinking particularly of 19th century scientist Michael Faraday, the condition is lifelong. In 1860, Faraday delivered the first of what would become annual Christmas lectures for children on the chemical history of the candle. A friend sent me the first four pages of the first lecture, and I was smitten. His warmth, his enthusiasm for his subject, his lyrical analyses. Here's an excerpt from the opening paragraph of his first lecture. There is no better, there is no more open door by which you can enter into the study of natural philosophy than by considering the physical phenomena of a candle. I trust, therefore, that I shall not disappoint you in choosing this for my subject rather than any newer topic, which could not be better were it even so good. This is a reproduction of a page from the 1861 printing of Faraday's lecture. He is speaking about the shape of a candle flame. You might be able to make some of the words out. It consists of a multitude of different shapes succeeding each other so fast. I wanted to write a poem about him, the candle, and the intertwining of wonder and looking away. I thought that I would place him at a window and then stand beside him, both of us looking out this time, both of us looking away. We're seeing a fresh snowfall and wondering about the tracks there. I thought of the poem as having two voices, Faraday's as he is thinking about what he'll say in his lecture, and mine as I muse about him and the snowy scene beyond the window, and having our two sensibilities intertwine in a fashion. Now, in the poem, in the printed form, his words are in italics. I will just pause a bit, and you won't have any trouble, I think, distinguishing where one voice ends and the other begins. Thoughts toward the first Christmas lecture. A skin of ice on the inner panes, and Faraday there at the window, his candle flame burning a peephole. Already morning has warmed the eaves, the hedgerows thickened by snow. Children, he thinks, penless, his words underscored by a tendril of smoke. I speak to you as a child myself, amazed by the candle's phenomena. Wax and light and uplifting air, the little cup they form together, the shallow pool that shivers there. Over an empty hummock, parallel tracks of a sleigh soften, and between the tracks a horse's widening hoofprints. Something has scurried across that journey, marten or hare, bisecting the sleigh tracks. Consider that grand circularity, light to fuel to light, and mystery, a flame that never bites the host but fattens from it nonetheless. Perhaps there were two horses stepping in tandem down the hummock, one set of hoof prints absorbing the other. Children, we are drawn here to be philosophers, to ask always, what is the cause? And so you question, how do flame and fuel meet? And so I say, by mutual attraction, by the bonding of things undissolved in each other. Unlikely, of course. Still, were their gates equal and the reins crossed their shoulders simultaneously. Let us turn to an illustration. Tip your towel to a basin of water, or better, trouble your mother for a fresh prawn, then place it tail first in a tumbler, plump head cupped over the rim. Children, water will climb through the creature as fuel climbs a wick by mutual attraction. Already morning has warmed the eaves, the icicles transparent now, sloughing their waxy frost, and soon to be prisms, blinding as the sun arcs into view. And what of the flame, you ask me? Its shadows so solid on the classroom wall, how can it be both substance and light? Perhaps there were two horses stepping in tandem down the wide expanse, soon to be blinding. Children, I must leave you for now with this. Never is flame of a single body, but a multitude of successions, so rapid the eye unites them as one. Something has scurried across the sleigh tracks, marten or hare, its jittery flight bisecting the hummock this way or that, its slim path both absence and shape, a low-slung whip of smoke. What did it tell me to do?
It
tells me to plug it in or find another power source. That sounds like what something that I would need. Everybody, any suggestions? I just want to move on to the next slide here. Maybe it will stop asking for that if I... Childhood and play, wonder and looking away. I think of James Watson trying so hard to find the bond for the strands that comprise the DNA molecule, which many of you recognize as this image. And I think of Elizabeth Bishop's words about creativity and Darwin. To quote her, "Dreams, works of art, glimpses of the almost more successful surrealism of everyday life, catch a peripheral vision of whatever it is one can never really see full face, but that seems enormously important. I can't believe that we are wholly irrational, and I do admire Darwin. But reading Darwin, one admires the beautiful and solid case being built up out of his endless heroic observations, almost unconscious or automatic. And then comes a sudden relaxation, a forgetful phrase, and one feels the strangeness of his undertaking, sees the lonely young man, his eyes fixed on facts and minute details, sinking or sliding giddily off into the unknown. What one seems to want in art, in experiencing it, is the same thing that is necessary for its creation, a self-forgetful, perfectly useless concentration," unquote. Bishop is in support of not seeing full face, of looking at a slant, of catching an essence peripherally. Darwin's to be admired for his endless heroic observations, but it is the sudden relaxation, the sinking or sliding giddily off into the unknown, the blue strand, that is so rewarding. Of course, the perfectly useless concentration must eventually yield to a useful concentration, as in refinement or revision, but not before inquiry and looking away are fully entwined. James Watson was exhausted in his efforts to envision DNA's bond. He cut geometric pieces of cardboard and glued toothpicks along the edges. He played a bit, turning the cardboard shapes until he saw the bond. Before I learned of Watson's discovery and the controversy surrounding fellow scientist Rosalind Franklin, I had been stunned by the cloning of Dolly. How might these two strands, Watson and Dolly, entwine? My looking away this time resulted not in a supportive counter image, but a supportive form. Not a geographer or tracks in snow, but an actual formal structure. Here were two subjects, and here was the double helix. The answer came to me in the form of the Pantoum. And for those of you who aren't familiar with it, it is the modern day Pantoum is comprised of four line stanzas. The second and the fourth line of one stanza becomes the first and third line of the next stanza. And so they braid together throughout the poem until at the very end, the first and third lines that open the stanza flip in reverse so that the line that started the poem ends the poem. I think most of, or many Pantoums are rhyming and metrical. Mine aren't, and I've taken a little liberty with the form, but you will hear the repeating lines. DNA, and there is a Dolly works her way in here, not overtly, but subtly. DNA, At hand, the rounded shapes, cloud white, the scissors sharp. 2 dozen toothpick pegs, a vial of amber glue. It's February, Cambridge, 1953, and he's at play, James Watson. The cardboard shapes, 2 dozen toothpick pegs, a vial of amber glue. White hexagons, pentagons, peg pierced at the corners. He's at play, James Watson, turning cardboard shapes this way, that. And where is that starshot elegance when hexagons, pentagons, peg pierced at the corners slip into their pliant, spiral flung alignments? Where is that starshot elegance? This way? That? He slips together lines of slender pegs that quickly split in two. Pliant, spiral flung, one line meant solitude, but one to one, pristine redundancy. He slips. Together, lines of slender pegs quickly conjugate. White hexagons, white pentagons, not solitude, but one, two, one, pristine redundancy. So close the spiral shape now, salt and sugar atoms congregate, white hexagons, white pentagons, so close the bud, the egg, the laboratory lamb, the salt and sugar atoms spiral shape, so close, it's February, Cambridge, 1953, the blossom, egg, the salutary lamb, so close at hand, the rounded shapes, cloud white, the scissors, sharp. As you might have detected in that poem, and perhaps we'll see more strongly in the next, my red strand of wonder has a third component, that is, awe and inquiry are joined by uncertainty. My science-inspired poems often seem fueled equally by praise and disquietude, a disquietude over the global implications of, in the wrong hands, a science increasingly adept at creating, extending, and annihilating life. But whether the poem's emotional center is praise or skepticism, my method is the same, to address the emotions peripherally and to braid disparate strands until each suggests more than itself. Perhaps not too unlike what Faraday did when he brought the candle's phenomena to the children. Wax and light and uplifting air, the little cup they form together, the shallow pool that shivers there. Marie Curie, as many of you know, died of radiation poisoning in 1934. That her years of work stirring a vat of pitch blende in order to isolate radium were gradually poisoning her, that she was a victim of her own steadfastness, was an unforgettable fact for me. 1934 was also the year that the painter Paul Cadmus was working on this piece called Gilding the Acrobats, and a year in which scientists were making great progress toward splitting the atom and toward the atomic bomb. Initially, I had my red strands, Marie Curie and the atom, but I wanted something else, something in counterpoint. I was looking through an art book and found Gilding the Acrobats. Chance? Serendipity? That particular book at that particular time? And how often, even in the highly controlled experiments of science, do we hear of chance? I'm remembering Alexander Fleming, credited with the discovery of penicillin, who was washing dishes, Petri dishes, when he noticed that one had a strange circle of mold. "That's funny," he said. "I wonder why." Of course, Fleming's work was preceded by centuries of interest in mold and fermentations, Pasteur and Lister and scores before them. And I mention this not to diminish Fleming's achievement, but to bring it more solidly into this talk. Fleming was prepared to be surprised. There's a good article by Fran Slowacek and Pamela Peters called Discovery, Chance, and the Scientific Method. They wrote, and I quote, "If the role of science, and I'd add poetry too, is to examine the world around us in a way that uncovers new and sometimes unexpected information, then science itself is intrinsically surprising. Even a deliberate scientific search for information may lead to an unexpected chance observation or discovery. But to have meaning, every observation or discovery must respond to a pre-existing pattern of ideas in the observer's mind. Discovery, like learning, is a phenomena that takes place in the human brain. The brain configures an event as a new pattern based on previous assumptions that were present at the onset of the event." Unquote. In other words, perhaps the most meaningful incidents of chance occur when the mind is prepared to be surprised. As Pasteur wrote, "In the field of observation, chance favors only the prepared mind." When I think of patterns in poetry, what comes to mind initially, of course, are metrical rhyming and syntactical patterns, and the meaningful ways that poets have varied them, and how alterations in each of these methods of communication is effective because we are aware of the original patterns. Alteration jars us. It cancels expectation. Expectation, that product of patterning. Alteration opens us to discovery. But thinking of poetry and chance suggests another path to discovery, one made by the union of observation and metaphoric thinking. Years of thinking metaphorically prepare poets to be surprised, to respond to a musical phrase or a cane stalk or a candle flame intuitively, to allow it to break an existing pattern of thought and, if we're lucky, set us off toward discovery. I'm not always lucky, but gilding the acrobats did stand out for me in an instant as a possible third strand for 1934, arrived at by the act of looking away for an encounter that was more than chance. And I think you all have a copy of this poem, 1934. Radiant in the Paris sun, the clustered chairs and canopies, the clustered leaves, one and one and one. And down the boulevard, the circus tent in a blousy park, the hospital, boulangeries, the institute where Curie turns, then takes in her blackened slender fingers a finger-shaped tube of radiation. And the blue Atlantic, radiant, the American shore, the gold-flecked palette Paul Cadmus lifts. It is a midday and sundown in March. He will paint on the flank of an acrobat a gilded skin. She will stroke down the test tube, a ticking wand. There is sunlight on their sleeves as the equinox shifts and the pale-bricked house of physics throws open its smallest doors. radiant. The boulevards and shorelines, the peat fields, polders, steepletops, the Appalachians, Pyrenees, the river-etched terraces of Warsaw. And the circus tent, with its acrobats, stern-faced and gilded, circling the ring on their parallel horses, radiant, their sudden shape, like Fission's sudden pyramid, one on the shoulders of two, two on the shoulders of four, four on the eight pumping, glistening haunches, and the 16 polished hooves, mute in the swirling dust. We actually have a little more DNA here for just a second. I've spoken this evening about moments of wonder over science that often inspire poems and the process of side glancing that might help to enrich a poem. But sometimes poems come almost fully formed. The material is there. All it needs is organization, perhaps some sonic or intellectual shaping. That happened to me not too long ago in the Children's Museum in London. And there, in one corner, were case after glass case of toys, starting with the oldest that the museum could find, and then working forward through time. And what was so startling to me was almost without exception, every toy tried some form of animation of the life that it was depicting. So, I mentioned earlier that the shape of the DNA molecule led me toward the Pantoum form, which in turn helped me to shape the poem's material. The abundance of toys in those glass cases suggested a poem in the form of a list without stanza breaks. As I wrote, I tried to add music to the list, primarily by the repetition of a single preposition. Those restrictions for this particular poem helped me organize my thoughts, helped me decide what to include and exclude and what to fabricate. Charles Darwin, coming back for a little bit, is one of my favorite figures. And I loved to find out that Darwin made lists too, and not lists just to help him solve scientific problems, but lists that helped him solve personal problems. So that in one of his biographies I read, he's trying to figure out whether or not to marry Emma, and maybe trying to figure out how to convince Emma whether or not that was a good idea. So Darwin took a sheet of paper and turned it sideways and wrote across the top, "This is the question." And then down one side, he had Mary, and he had children, lifelong companions, and then on the other side, not Mary, no children, freedom, and the list went on. But the one that I loved for this talk particularly was the one that he made in response to his father's objections to him going on the Beagle. And he meticulously wrote down every objection that his father had and then responded to them in a letter. His list, which he included in a letter to his father, begins with fragments that are dissimilar structurally, much as his Mary, not Mary list did. "Disreputable to my character as a clergyman hereafter," was his first entry, followed by "a wild scheme." As the list progresses, however, the presentation changes. Darwin precedes each entry with the word "that." that they must have offered to many others before me the place of naturalist, that I should never settle down to a steady life hereafter, that my accommodations would be most uncomfortable, that you should consider it again as changing my profession, that it would be a useless undertaking. As the list progressed from jittery phrase to crafted phrase, I believe that control shifted from the father, originator of the objections, to the son, shaper of them. Syntax and music diminished what might otherwise have been experienced as a random, ceaseless outpouring from the father. I'm not suggesting that Charles Darwin was aware of using a rhetorical device as a method for control. Nevertheless, the formal pattern did arise in his list, and I believe it helped him to organize not only his objections, but his responses to them. Certainly, he would be among the first to attest to the presence of formal patterning just beyond our awareness. My word in this poem wasn't that, but before. And I didn't restrict myself only to the toys found in the Children's Museum, but they were the inspiration for this poem. As I mentioned, toy after toy contained some form of animation. Among my favorites were Gustav the Climbing Miller, and this is the big test here, this is Miss Otto Peripatetikos. She is the unassisted walking one. Now, this isn't the actual doll that they have in the British Museum, but she's close enough. And this is what I imagine she would be like. Now, let me just get this right on here. It's only 5 seconds. That's my YouTube video. That is the creepiest thing. I mean, that they decide that they have to get her face closer and closer. The poem is called Simulacra. And the U that you hear in this, in the first moment of the poem, is E-W-E. Simulacra. Before the beak of a tiny pipette dipped through a glisten of DNA, and you quickened to you with exactly the simulacrum 40,000 years had worked toward. Before Moybridge's horses cantered and a ratchet and Paul Cast waltzing couple shuffled along a phasmotrope. Before dime-size engines sparked in the torsos of toddler dolls and little bellows let them sing, and the unassisted walking one, Miss Otto Peripatetikos, stepped in her caterpillar gait across the new world's wide plank floor. Before motion moved the figures and torsion moved the motion, or steam, or sand, or candle flame, before magnets and taut springs nudged Gustav the Climbing Miller up his mill's retaining wall and gravity retrieved him, before image like sound stroked through an outreach of crests and troughs and corresponding apertures caught patterns in the waves, caught like eels beneath ancestral ponds, radiance in the energy. Before lamposcope and zograscope, phantoscope and panorama, before lanterns recast human hands or a dye drop of beetle first fluttered across a flicker book of papyrus leaves. Someone sketched a creature along the contours of a cave, its stippled monochromatic shape tracing the vaults and hollows, shivers of flank and shoulder, already drawing absence nearer, as torchlight set the motion and shadow set the rest. And there's just another minute or two. In closing, I'd like to share a quote with you from poet and scientist Mario Petrucci. I believe science and poetry can successfully coexist, but not through the injection of science into poems in an arbitrary manner or as a kind of technological name-dropping. The science has to be fully absorbed into the creative writing process so that the poems achieve a negotiated cohabitation, an organic balance. As I mentioned, my background in science was quite limited. As a poet without scientific training, I react to existing phenomena rather than participate in their making. As such, I approach the material of science always as an outsider striving for the negotiated cohabitation that Petrucci mentions, the organic balance between the revelations of science as I understand them and the revelations of the poem as a work of art. As you've heard tonight, scientific phenomena triggers so many of my poems, its arrival unbidden, just a moment of arrested attention when visual image or sound or fact stops me in my tracks, and the aftermath of that moment, when, as Bishop says, eyes fixed on facts or minute details, one slides off into the unknown, the blue strand's territory. For me, the aftermath contains the gradual understanding of the metaphoric significance of the moment of arrested attention, which in turn becomes the poem. And perhaps the organic balance that Petrucci desires can be achieved through the roots of metaphor. Regardless of the depth of one's research or study, and in recognition of the evocativeness of the scientific process itself as a source for poetry, perhaps it is through at least a provisional understanding of metaphoric implications that non-practitioners can discover, shape, and achieve in their poems that organic balance. Perhaps not. Perhaps the answer lies elsewhere. Or, as I prefer to believe, perhaps there are multiple answers. One day, while looking in an encyclopedia for something else, I came across an entry on the mirror, and it contained what I thought was a wonderful fact, and I hope it hasn't been since disproved. I love older encyclopedias, so who knows, anything may have happened. But the fact was that in order for a mirror to reflect the object, the whole of it, the mirror must be at least half the size of the object to be reflected. And I loved that, and I went, and we have a little mirror in the kitchen, and I backed away, and I backed away, and I backed away, and no matter how far I went, I could not see all of me. And so maybe that is a true thing. I certainly hope so. This is the last image, and this will be the last poem. This is an image of two mirrors and one candle. I wish that the mirrors had been flat, because this idea of reflecting half and et cetera, they're referring to a flat mirror, instead of what I think are concave and convex. But the slide contained a candle and mirrors and helps me circle back to where we began this evening. Imagine Michael Faraday at a lectern. He has a small mirror in his hand. At his side is a tall, thin lamp. I chose again the Pantum form for this poem, its repeating lines suggesting source and reflection for me, but also the individual strands of science and art, context and poem, as they move interdependently and together across the page in a bonding of things undissolved in each other. On reflection. I will never contain the whole of it, he said. The mirror too small for the long-necked lamp, floating swan-like near the angle of incidence. Never, he said, stepping back from the lectern and long-necked lamp, the mirror he held too small for the swan. To reflect the object entirely, he said, stepping back to the lectern, the glass must be half the source's height. To reflect the object entirely, the lamp, or a swan, or my figure before you, the glass must be half the source's height, unlike thought, which easily triples the whole. My figure before you, the lamp swan, reflects my object entirely, that is, unlike thought, which easily triples or transforms the whole, the mirror is bound by harmony, entirely, unlike the object reflected. Finally, when you back away from the glass your image, the mirror is bound by harmony, always doubles the distance between you. As it finally backs away through the glass, light doubling its loss through angles of reflection, your image doubles the distance between you, always twice as far from the mirror as you are before it. Like a thought, doubly lost through an act of reflection, floating swan-like past its angle of incidence, twice as far from its mate as a lamp from a mirror that will never contain the whole of it. That's all. I'll stop then. Thank you so much. Not too technical.
Yeah. I ask because it's such a beautiful space of meditation and feeling.
But if you wouldn't, that's okay too.
He would pause and say, did I get that right or wrong? Passion. Yes, that is right.
Great. Can't disagree with that. Sounds good to me.
People can hear better. It's not a good room.
My name is Mary, and I
that haven't made their way into poems yet? Well, I think that almost all of the poems in the last few books have those moments of wonder at their hearts. So, as the mirror did, ones that are orphaned that haven't found poems yet. I don't think there are any that are still floating around, but it's interesting for me as a writer, because what has a tendency to happen is I'll be receptive to these chance encounters that aren't really chance when I need them. But when I'm in the middle of writing a poem, I don't usually have that happen. It's almost as if that receptivity stops because the concentration is so great on the poem that I'm writing. So now that that I'm sort of free to do more creative work, I have a sense this is going to happen again, and I'll have a few in the notebook in reserve. Thanks. Yes. Yes, I think that's a wonderful question, and I wonder in terms of using Browning or the persona, the dramatic monologue, to reveal aspects of character, where those aspects that are to be revealed are less than admirable. I'm attracted to certain characters less for their personal lives than I am for what their achievements represent to a society or civilization, so that there's, I think, less of a tendency for me to be drawn to people who have not had those achievements, because it's not where my interest lies in a kind of character revelation. Oh, well, thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Yes. Well, I did do readings of my work through the medical school at Columbia University, because they were very interested in narrative medicine and wanted to have poets particularly come and address the young medical students, and that was very rewarding for me, but it wasn't a lecture. It was a reading of the work. I'm not sure that I would feel confident enough to speak to a group of scientists about, I don't know. It's something I would have to think about. As I say, I'm such an outsider to this and coming at it in a kind of the way an artist does, that it might, I'm not sure there would be enough of interest to them, and I don't know. I'll have to think about it. Good question. I'll think about it. Somebody ask me, and then I'll decide whether I'm up to it. I would have to take them at a very elementary level, but it would be, were there world enough in time, I would love to take some art classes too and some music classes, and so I haven't, there was so much that I would like to do, and I'm not sure if the process, which is this sort of unbidden, arrested attention over something that appears to be of wonder to me, whether that would be a productive thing to have happen in a class, that it might be that wouldn't feed the poetry in the way that I would hope that it would. So having not all the hours left to me in the world, I might not choose to spend them that way.
I kept thinking through this.
Yeah.
Back to Eliot's line. Age of chaos theory.
Herb, it's so hard. It's such a hard idea. And so, yes, and I wish I knew more about it, because I think metaphorically it is a wonderful stitch between the two, between science and art. But it's so mind-boggling to me that I haven't gone there yet. Yes. Okay. Herb, I meant it all along. My Faraday poem is exactly, it was based on chaos theory. I just wasn't quite sure then. Yeah, and I think that it wasn't a growing up. It was just very, very early years. By the time I was six, just about seven, we had moved here. My dad was with Alaska Airlines, and they had their base in Anchorage. And then they moved to SeaTac, and so we moved here. So I spent the time, I was about 2 until 6 and a half in Anchorage. But again, it was all I remember because I was just a little child. They would put us to bed at a reasonable hour, so I don't remember the endless light in the summers, but I do remember my mother taking me to kindergarten in the dark and coming home pretty much in the dark and the snow. So, but that's all. It doesn't have enough influence, I think, to be more than really a kind of primary.
Great. To thank you.
Thank you so much for coming. Thank you. You can put our lights up, I bet.
If you did not receive...